An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals. Today is Wednesday. It's April 3rd, 2024, and it's 2:43 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and you found the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for joining us, and do share us with your friends. Say, hey, you ought to listen to this Mincing Rascals podcast. And email us, too, just to johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. We'd like your feedback, your suggestions, your criticisms, and the praise. Bring in a lot of praise, too. Email me, johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hi, John. I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago Reporter columnist, and now doing the Chicago History website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Marge Helper, and I have a couple decades of experience in state and local politics, currently a pundit, commentator, and a community organizer with One Community Near South, paying close attention to the potential development of new stadiums in my community.
I'm Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a Substack newsletter, and former columnist for the Tribune.
Marge, you didn't mention that you're also, are you still doing commentary on Canadian TV?
I am. I left that off. And on WCPT.
Here's a sidebar. Speaking of Canada, you know, sometimes in the past we recommended things at the end of the podcast, and were we to do that today, I would recommend The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. It's a new book that's out. I'm going to talk to the author this week. It is so much fun. And it just talks about who John Belushi was from his childhood and Dan Aykroyd, how they came together, how they became the Blues Brothers, how Animal House got made. So it's about all of that. But the thing is, the number of Canadians in the early years of Saturday Night Live, it's just amazing how these names pop up and you go, oh, yeah, that guy. Oh, yeah, that guy. Holy cow.
Second City connection, right?
Absolutely.
Second City, yeah. Toronto. Right.
So it was Second City, yeah, Toronto. Yeah. And when they would switch the cast, sometimes they'd have Toronto come to Chicago and Chicago would go work in Toronto for a while. When the Toronto cast came here, it was really the cast that you kind of knew from SNL. It was so many familiar names and faces. And the struggles, the infighting, the drugs, it's just great intrigue. It's really, really fascinating and fun. It's called The Blues Brothers, and it's by Daniel DeVisa. And that's DeVisa.
They rewatched the movie, actually.
Oh, I know. It does make me want to go back and watch the movie, for sure.
Hurry up, because I think they're taking it off, the streaming.
Oh, really?
I think Canadian Connection includes that Joe Flaherty, I believe. I mean, yes. He was on SCTV, and he just passed away this week.
He's actually from Pittsburgh. He started in Chicago for a couple of years before he went to Toronto. Not to take anything away from the Canadians.
He was a big part of Kids in the Hall. Did you ever watch Kids in the Hall?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're wonderful.
I didn't watch Freaks and Geeks either, and I'm told I
did. Oh, you did? Oh, my God, John. Oh.
I know.
Freaks and Geeks is totally up your alley.
I know.
It is. You've never watched You guys haven't watched Freaks and Geeks, have you? Oh, my God. You've got to get that. It's so good. Linda Cardellini and Seth Rogen and Flaherty is the father in the show. John, it's our generation, totally.
Here's a paragraph in the book, by the way, which just kind of speaks to this point of the marriage between Canada and Chicago. It says, by the summer of 1974, the Second City operations in Chicago and Toronto were operating a vigorous exchange program. The Toronto cast traveled to Chicago in August to perform a review titled The Canadian Show One or Upper U.S. say, largely unknown outside Canada, the Toronto troupe included sandy-haired performer named John Candy, a versatile wiry-haired Ontarian named Eugene Levy, a glamorous rubber-faced blonde named Catherine O'Hara, a lovable Michigander Gilda Radner, and a mysterious mustachioed Ottawan named Dan Aykroyd. Like, oh, you just kind of see these pieces coming together, and it's fun to watch it get assembled in real time.
And speaking of Levy and O'Hara, they are, of course, the stars of Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
Which I think we've all watched. Haven't we watched Schitt's Creek?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Griffin challenged us the other day. He goes, okay, five favorite TV shows of all time, go. There goes 2 hours. For me, it was West Wing. It was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I might put Schitt's Creek on there now that I think about that. I was so resistant to falling in love with that show because I didn't like the title.
Same. Absolutely the same. I resisted it for years.
I thought, oh, this will be stupid.
People, yeah, that sounds really juvenile.
Exactly.
Which it is. I mean, in fairness, that title is really juvenile, but...
Patriotism, guys, is weirdly a big topic lately for us at WGN. You have Donald Trump endorsing and selling God Bless the USA Bibles. You have the LSU women's basketball team that wasn't on the court for the national anthem before their game against Iowa. And the Chicago City Council is not going to censure or kick off committee one alderman who spoke at an event where the American flag was burned. Now we've talked about that story before on this podcast. Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez spoke at a Cancel the DNC rally, and Alderman Chris Taliaferro led a charge against him because Sigcho Lopez was near a burning U.S. flag. We all agreed, I think, that the bigger crime here was the purpose of that rally, to undermine a peaceful convention in our town. But if you really want to get people going this week, stand with LSU coach Kim Mulkey and argue that it is not important for the team to be there for the national anthem.
It feels like nostalgia to me, because we're fighting about flag burning, which I thought we had settled back in 1989 with the Texas v. Johnson decision for the U.S. Supreme Court that said it was protected freedom of expression. I think one clearly has the right to burn an American flag, whether it's a good idea. No, I don't think it is. I think it's not a particularly coherent statement generally, but I think you have the right to do it. And I think anyone who burns it, you should shrug it off. As far as the national anthem goes, I think it's a very peculiar tradition that we sing it or perform it before athletic events, but not before concerts or plays or religious services or anything else. Really, it's limited to that. And I've challenged people who get all upset about it, people not standing, say, for the national anthem or ignoring it. Do you really sit in front of your TV or stand up in front of your TV at home when the national anthem comes on and take your hat off and sing along? No, you don't. Of course you don't. Nobody does. It's a performance. It's a performance of it. It's, you know, the right loves to complain about virtue signaling. I can think of nothing that is more performatively virtue signaling than standing up and singing along to the national anthem in a group when you don't do it at home.
But to the degree that it is. But let me interject this, Eric, because I think we're all probably going to land in the same spot on this, but to the degree that it is that, what do you signal when you don't stand or participate in the national anthem? What are you saying?
What I believe you're signaling is that you feel like you live in a country that ostensibly represents these values of liberty, freedom, justice for all things, all the things that we claim that our country represents, and you feel like the country is not living up to those things. You're not rejecting those ideals. You're rejecting the way the country is not living up to them. That would be my understanding. That's certainly why Colin Kaepernick was kneeling. He felt like he was signaling that he felt that the police and then law enforcement in this country was not treating black people well or equally or fairly. And that's what he was saying, that does not live up to our standards. So that you're kneeling to show that you don't believe this is happening and that the flag stands for that. I think, I mean, if you're rejecting the U.S. Constitution, if you're rejecting what this country stands for, that's a whole different thing. But it's my understanding of it, and I think it can be a legitimate statement, certainly, to say that I think that this country ostensibly stands for one thing, but is actually doing another. So when you talk about patriotism, you think about all the things that Donald Trump has said he wants to do that are un-American, that would be unpatriotic, and yet he likes to hug the U.S. flag and claim that he's selling a Bible that's an American Bible. That to me is ironic beyond words.
The whole thing drips with irony and, in fact, hypocrisy, because the very things that the far right stands for are, in the ways you're saying, Eric, fundamentally un-American. The idea that the people who don't agree with you are going to be rounded up, that would be us on the left, who would be rounded up under another Trump administration. The Bible itself, mixing the picture of the flag with the Bible, is the ultimate church and state melding, not to mention all the what has he got in there? The Pledge of Allegiance and all this other stuff.
Constitution
in there.
And the lyrics to God Bless the USA.
Oh, yeah. Right. So, and the fundamental slogan by which they march and protest in cities and rally in cities across the country, Make America Great Again. America was not great for a huge percentage of the population. It was pretty good for the patriarchy, if I could use the overused word, but for the white male leaders, the people who don't want to step aside for new leadership in this country now, it did pretty well for them. But for great many of people in this country, it was not great. And the ideas about how to restore equity and values to people who did not get them in Trump's world is seen as anti-American. I thought that's what our country really is about.
You know, I mean, we're talking about several different things at the same time, really. Let me isolate just the Alderman Siju Lopez thing. One of the good things about that was actually everybody who spoke on that was actually very clear that they completely agreed that it should be a First Amendment right. They had no problem with the veteran having a First Amendment right to burn that flag. But that's what it got turned into. Mm-hmm. Even though if you did see any sound bites from the actual press conference that Alderman Taliaferro kind of led with something like 11 or 12 other aldermen with him on that, they made it clear even at that press conference that they were not calling that into question. So, I mean, really, we can all rest kind of easy that none of our elected officials here in Chicago are in any way trying to infringe on that First Amendment right. Their issue was that they thought it was wrong for an elected official to associate themselves with that.
With the group.
With both things. They right away were like, come on, you saw that flag on the ground. Everyone knows he knows that the flag was there on the ground having been burned. So that's kind of silly. Just as importantly, but really more importantly, they did say more importantly, that he was associating himself with and lending legitimacy to the group behind enemy lines that was putting on that protest. Mm-hmm. Because we talked about last week how extremely fringe that group is, and that the point of what they're doing right now is to advocate first trying to shut down the Democratic National Convention. And they are very specific. If you look at their social media, if we can't do that, the way they put it is they want to stop the coronation of President Biden, who they call Genocide Joe, for what's going on in Gaza.
You know, and I wonder if that whole movement is a movement of the moment, but really won't resonate in November. You know, make a statement about what's happening. Who knows what our position is or what's going to be happening in Gaza in November? I wonder if this is a snapshot, but it's not something that is going to loom so large in 6 months.
If there isn't some resolution to the disaster that is happening in Gaza, it will hurt Biden. I have no doubt about that. And the problem is Netanyahu is in the same position as Trump, right? As long as he's in power and in office, he can't go to jail. So it's likely that Netanyahu, if he and as long as this war is continuing, it seems the constituency in Israel doesn't want to change leadership. So it's in his interest to continue the war and ignore the calls for ceasefire or peace settlement, because that keeps him in office, keeps him out of jail. And better yet, if he can hold out till Trump is elected, which he probably would prefer, he clearly would prefer, then he's going to have a more favorable outlook on the brutality that's happening in Gaza, because Trump seems to support that.
But the U.S. so administration,
that's not helping Biden at all.
But the U.S. has been softening its position on this. We are not nearly as allied with Israel and what they're doing as we were once upon a time. That was the point of my question. Come November, I don't know how much resonance the disruption of the DNC is going to have.
Biden is going to have to thread this needle, and it's not easy, but he's going to have to continue to move in the direction he's moving in. He had some pretty harsh words to say this morning, and I think he's continuing to try to push Israel into a more conciliatory position. But if he fails, and in November, and the thing is, it's a marginal election. So what is it going to cost him? Maybe no more than 3%. Well, if RFK takes 3% and this issue cuts him by 3%, all of these things are going to make this close election even closer. We don't have a lot of percent to waste.
This World Central Kitchen issue that has popped up in the last few days, the slaughter of the workers over there, inadvertent, the Israelis are saying, but just sort of a symbol of how indiscriminate the killing has been over there. Really harmful, really outraged President Biden, and I think outraged a lot of us about the way that war is being conducted. But I agree with John that it is kind of a snapshot. But it won't be a snapshot if Chicago descends into chaos in mid-August. It's not going to help Joe Biden. And I think that these behind enemy lines people need to take a more realistic look at who's going to be better for Gaza, for the causes of people in Palestine, Donald Trump or Joe Biden, because those are your choices. You know, RFK Jr. is not going to be elected president. Nobody else is going to be elected president, but one of those two is. And that's where you have to make that decision. And I get the idea you want to call attention to this problem. I think it's great that they're going to protest if they want to raise their voices and say, this is the path we need to take. But at the end of the day, this is a binary choice. And you've got to decide which one is going to be better, because you don't get your third choice. So I get raising the issue, I get putting pressure on Biden, but if you don't come home and vote for him when the time comes, then you're going to elect somebody. I mean, Netanyahu's favorite candidate is Donald Trump, pretty clearly, right? What does that tell you? I'd like to ask these activists, like, what do they think they're going to accomplish if they urge their people not to vote for Joe Biden? They're making people take a pledge online. I will never vote for Joe Biden. This is a commitment I'm making. Like, what do you really think your options are? I just don't understand that mindset at all.
I don't know if it's a genuine desire to pull votes away from Biden. If people stay home, that's a vote for Trump, and it's our job to make sure everybody understands that. Just like, you know, vote for Jill Stein and you're voting against Hillary Clinton, and that's what happened, right? So, but I think the goal is to push Biden to be more aggressive in fighting for peace and a resolution with Israel. And actually, he has been. I don't think it's this fringe group's result. I don't think they're the ones who are achieving this. But I think some of the work that's been done in primaries, the uncommitted vote in Detroit, and this week in Wisconsin, there was the unrestricted electors. They picked, I think, a handful of unrestricted electors in the final vote in the primary this week. So they're inching in to give more and more leverage to push Biden on this issue. This pledge never to vote for Biden, I don't know how many people will take that very seriously, but it's raising the specter that he has to be responsive to on this issue. And I think he hears that, and he is.
But does it advance the cause to get into fights with cops on the streets of Chicago, for instance? And I think the answer is no to that. And that's where the tone of the city council, I didn't hear the whole meeting, Kate, you did. Was there any talk that the aldermen need to be four square or 50 square against violent street protests, in favor of peaceful protests, but really saying we cannot have the kinds of scenes in Chicago in 2024 that we had in 1968, and that anyone who thinks that that's a good idea needs to be corrected. Even the Democratic Socialists, who are far left on this issue, need to stand and say with one voice that this should not and will not happen in Chicago.
I listened to Alderman Sergio Lopez, who spoke first, and Alderman Taliaferro and Alderman Bill Conway. Sergio Lopez would simply not address that entire issue. He made it to be out to be 100% about whether or not the veteran at the rally had a right to burn the flag, whereas he had already met with Alderman Taliaferro and Conway and Villegas, who had told him that that was not the issue on Easter. And he even acknowledged that they had that meeting and said that it was in good faith. And yet he did like a 10 or 15 minute speech where he really just literally screamed the entire time and would not acknowledge anything beyond the flag burning as being the issue. And then the others spoke and they were very calm and straightforward about it and said, you know, that's not what we're talking about. We're fine with the flag burning. Our problem is with you lending credence to it as an elected official, and our problem is with you being with this violent group.
But what they didn't make clear is, what does that have to do with his role as chairman of the housing committee? That was flat out retribution, flat out partisan politics that I frankly feel sad to see the kind of division in our city council that we're seeing across the country. It's inevitable. I can't be surprised, but I hate to see it. All this talk about, you know, veterans' rights. Well, the veteran has a right to burn the flags. So do we, if we want to. I mean, you have no additional rights as a veteran. I respect their service and appreciate it, but it got into all that faux patriotism, to go back to your original point, John, about because that's a veteran, this is somehow more outrageous. But what do you all make of the Tribune's suggestion today that, sure, Sergio Lopez is an activist, he was elected because of his progressive positions, but now that he's in office, he needs to shed that and be a more staid, responsive elected official. I don't have the wording in front of me, but that's how I heard it, right? Yeah.
I thought what they were saying, I won't quote the exact passage right now, although I could probably look it up in a second, but was that, of course, we all have our right to free speech, but you do bear a greater responsibility if you're going to be a representative of the people of the city. So I don't know that they were asking him to compromise his values or the things he got elected upon. You don't suppose the people that elected him into office wanted the DNC to go down in flames, do you?
No, but I do think they want him to be vocal on the horrors of Gaza, which he has consistently done. He's picked the wrong ally.
Exactly.
I believe, and I agree with. But the Tribune passage we're both talking about, neither of us have it in front of us, but the passage really kind of literally said that now that he's an elected official, he's got to leave some of that behind. I'm not so sure that that would be responsive to the people who elected him.
It is a political thing, really up to his own constituents, since that's who he's representing. If he was my alderman, I would not vote for him again. That's me. The question will be what his own constituents think of it. It reminds me of the book that we're all probably reading right now, right? Gregory Pratt's book on Lori Lightfoot, The City Is Up for Grabs.
Yeah.
There is one point fairly early on in the book where an insider tells him, you know, how Lori Lightfoot is just like constantly not dealing well or with various individuals and groups. And her staff are saying, hey, she's not a politician. And this insider was like, when she got elected as mayor of the third largest city in the country, whether she likes it or not, now she is a politician and she needs to start acting like a politician. And I think that was true of Lori Lightfoot. I do think it's true of an alderman, too, although, again, it's up to his own constituents to decide whether or not they think he has acted enough as a politician that represents a large group of people. It will be up to them.
Make a press conference out of it. But to have a policy or a retribution, you know, punitive discussion on the floor of the city council did not feel appropriate to me.
They did at first just talk about censoring him and maybe they would call for a meeting. You know, if his response had been just a little bit more ameliatory.
A Tribune editorial says that Sergio Lopez is signaling that ideology trumps all, that everyone must take a side in all matters, that one side is good, the other evil, and there are no leadership figures left in America to act as honest brokers. They say Mayor Johnson should tell Sergio Lopez to stop with this immature nonsense and behave like a public official whose constituents and city come first. Chicago is not going to cancel the DNC, and the last thing we need is violent disruption from a group that believes reasonable protest doesn't go far enough. I don't know that they're telling him not to be true to his beliefs. I think they're telling him that he does have to put the interests of the city and his constituents ahead of what his ideology is, even though I think he was elected because of his ideology, right? Mm-hmm. He's a democratic socialist, so unapologetic about it. But, you know, I would stand with the idea that he should be thinking about the whole city as well as his constituents.
Yeah, right.
About what the DNC means. And so that's where I would come down on this. Because I'm all in favor of people expressing their views on Gaza, and I have a lot of the reservations that they have about the way that war is being conducted over there. It's horrific what's happening, no question about it. And I don't know that there are any easy solutions, but you know, Hamas has got to give up its hostages if it's going to expect a ceasefire, and that could happen if they wanted to do that. And you know, you're going to hold me back on 70 years of history to say why they're not going to do it. But it's a very complicated situation that doesn't yield itself to simple solutions. And I think that as a politician, as an elected leader, he needs to keep his eyes on that.
Well, it reminds me in a way at this moment of the conversation we had about Brandon Johnson and Bring Chicago Home. When we were talking about that with Brandon Pope and Austin Berg, and I was reminding the guys that they elected him on that platform. So that's what you get. That's the package. And one of them was saying, well, just because you got elected on that package by a slim margin doesn't mean that you have to now do everything that you campaigned on. You're a thinking, feeling human being. Things change. And so maybe your decisions or your votes get a little more nuanced, right? It's not a blank check for every single thing you want to do or you believe in. You have to represent a constituency. You got to think here that if Sixto Lopez feels that way about these issues, fine, but pick your battles, pick your spots. You know, we started this conversation talking a little bit about patriotism and how some of these issues are tied together. I did, just before we leave all of this and go on to a couple of other things, want to go back to the LSU basketball game and the fact that the women's basketball team did not stand on the court for the national anthem beforehand. It does seem to be sort of a forced display of patriotism, doesn't it? That we want you to be there so that we will know that you are patriotic Americans, and we want you to be patriotic Americans. It's very easy to not like the LSU women's basketball coach, and I think the whole thing was sort of pitted as a good guys versus the bad guys kind of basketball game. It's why it was one of the most watched sporting events of any stripe in years. More people watched that game this week than watched any NBA game last year but one, and that was game 5 of the playoffs. So it was a very hot topic. Everybody was looking at it. And when LSU doesn't stand for the national anthem, people judge them as not being sufficiently patriotic or, say, appreciative of all of the things that America affords them.
Well, it's not like they stood in front and took a knee. In the Kaepernick example, I think that was fully justified in the way that Eric said earlier. But they weren't there, right? And the coach actually said later that she didn't know the anthem was being played. They typically come off the court. She says, I'm reading a quote from her, at the 12-minute mark.
Yep.
We do our pregame stuff. They were off getting ready for the game. And doing whatever motivational stuff. I don't know what they're doing back there, but they didn't even know that that was happening. It's not like they refused to be there or refused to show their respect.
And no, but what they refused to do was they knew that the national anthem gets played before the game. What they didn't do was adjust their schedule to accommodate the display for the national anthem.
Which they never do.
And they're not the only team that doesn't do that. But people want them to do that. They want them to stand and respect it. They want you and I to stand for the national anthem at a Cubs game or a Bulls game or a Blackhawks game. And if you don't, like Eric said, then you seem to be saying something, but it's such a blunt instrument. I think what we should do is, like, you should stand erect to the degree that you're happy with America. So if you're straight up, you're 100% in. If you're not there, you're really upset. But maybe if you're bent over like at a 75-degree angle, you're a little upset about the way things are going right now, and we can judge your patriotism.
I'm leaning to the left.
I want you bent over and leaning a little to the left when you do
it. Know exactly where I stand. I'm leaning to the left.
But what does that even mean, leaning to the left? Does that make you more or less patriotic? I don't even know.
Here's the problem, John. This whole thing is ratcheting up a lot of anger and a lot of false anger that serves the alt-right. What Trump is doing in his textbook It is textbook to try to sow this division to make people angry. Go back to the Sigcho Lopez issue. All this emphasis, they said, as Kate noticed, it noted that it wasn't about the burning of the flag. We all agree that they have a right. The guy was a veteran, and they're trying to show whether you respect the veterans or not. All that is divisive. It's demanding that you prove your patriotism and your love of America. The on the right-wing Twitter is just awash with quotes about how Biden hates America, right? Who hates America? We all want it to be better in the ways that we think it would be better. But what it does do is stir up violence in the street. Don't worry about the DNC, because the violence is already happening. Sigcho Lopez has had death threats, and his family was threatened. Of course he was screaming, Kate. He was pretty shaken, I think, by all that. I would be, and I think you would be too. And he, whether he made a good choice or not, it's blown up in a way that is frightening. Did you see that study this week that when Trump holds a rally, the number of hate crimes in the counties and communities where he holds his rally spike up for a month in every one of these cities all around the country? They want us to be having this kind of argument. It's a false flag, if I could not try to be punny about it, but it's not patriotism. It's not making our country better. It's making us angrier.
Yeah, the Republican governor of Louisiana tweeted out on Tuesday that it's time that all college boards put a policy in place that student athletes be present for the national anthem or risk their athletic scholarship. And so what he's saying is that living in the land of the free and the home of the brave, the freedom does not include refraining from participating in this ostentatious ritual that celebrates what a free country we live in.
What's more un-American than that?
Exactly. It's easy to get stirred up. What do you mean both are, John?
Well, because I don't even like Marge's question. What's more American or un-American than that? I think it's a loser argument to try and judge somebody's patriotism or Americanness. If I want to stand up ramrod straight and put my hand over my heart at every time someone sings the national anthem, and I value that and I desire that, who would have a problem with that? Or should I celebrate the freedom to be angry at this country and to express that? That's a very American thing too. So I'm going to sit down. I don't know which is
the problem, John, is that I'm one who stands for the national anthem in part because I'm a conformist when it comes to public displays. Like,
you don't want to get yelled at.
Attention, but in part because I do love this country and I do love what it stands for. And it doesn't mean by standing up, I'm not saying I love everything this country does. I love everything the military does. I love everything that the police do and all our politicians. Obviously, I don't. But I do believe in what our country stands for and in what the American experiment is ostensibly about. So I don't have any problem standing up for that. And other people who see it as standing up for what the country is doing right now, they have a different feeling about the anthem. It means something different to all of us.
Yeah.
You can justify standing. You can justify sitting if you want, if you think that you're making that statement. But the right to make that statement is very clear to me, and it's very important to me. And I think there's very few countries in this world where you could burn a flag or, you know, give the finger, so to speak, to a national symbol or a national song and not stay out of jail. And we should celebrate that.
Maybe what's most off-putting is the necessity to state your feelings about the country before a sporting event, right? Like, I'm going to sit or stand and be judged as a result. Why the hell do I have to do that before the women's basketball game? Can we just play the game and not have this show of allegiance?
Typically, when you're actually at a sporting event, no one is looking around to police other people about whether or not they're eating their hot dog or standing up and singing. So it's really not normally an issue, but the people who are down there on the playing field, for them, they are very visible, right? And they are being judged.
Yeah.
I'm very ambivalent about it because I really cannot stand to be told what to do, which I've probably said before, it's from going to Catholic school for 12 years. So I'm really against that, having been forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance for so long.
That's also in the law in Illinois. The schools require that.
Yep. And I do dislike that. At the same time, I enjoy that part of a sporting event where everyone is, maybe not every single person, but most of the crowd is kind of into it. It's a good feeling when everyone gets together and does that. And I understand that there's no real reason to do it for a sporting event. But when you think about it, if we didn't do it for those sporting events, when would we do it? There's so few civic things like that that we have anymore.
But isn't that the question that's on the ballot right now? Whether everyone has the right to have their own, exercise their own freedoms and interpret freedom the way they want, but no one has the right to do that for other people. I mean, that's the fundamental question about whether we're a Christian nation or not, right?
What are you referring to, Biden versus Trump? What's on the ballot?
Mm-hmm. I am. Okay. And I the whole division in the country right now is that this is my view of how everyone needs to act. So everyone needs to act that way. And I think you hear that a little bit from both sides, probably, but mostly at the moment from the right.
If we go with what's the worst thing the right is doing right now, certainly these Trump Bibles. That's the worst example from the right now. But I feel like the left was doing more demagoguing on the flag issue with Alderman Cedro Lopez because it was not about the flag.
Marge, you were an observer for the primary in Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yes. I was stationed at a school on behalf of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin to observe the election process there.
And what are you looking for? What do you observe?
Just to make sure that everyone gets a chance to vote, that their rules about identification and proof of residency are pretty convoluted now, and some judges are confused by them, and we just want to make sure that everyone that presents the appropriate materials and identification does indeed get to vote. The setting where I was, there were two wards, they're like precincts, two jurisdictions that were voting in the same space. There was zero problem. There was nothing there really to report, although I was kind of stunned to see that their ballots don't have the paper ballots where I was. They don't have sleeves or jackets. You know, we get to hide our ballot after we fill it out and then bring it to somebody and you slip it in carefully and let it go. They just wave their ballot around. Sometimes they give it to somebody to put in the machine. And if it's rejected, it comes back out and they both look at it together to see where the mistake was. If there was a lack of privacy for the ballots, that was jarring to me, but a common procedure there anyway. But otherwise,
what were the results of the election? Did anything surprise you in the primary results?
They had two referenda on the ballot that both passed. I don't know if I'm totally surprised, but I'm very disappointed that they passed because they're part of this national movement by Republicans to further to further sow confusion around elections, to tamp down the vote any way they can. So one of them, and they're like the 27th state to pass something like this, barring grants and outside funding for election purposes. They're specifically targeting the nonprofit that Mark Zuckerberg set up to help election procedures during the pandemic when they were understaffed and under-equipped and they provided more ballot drop boxes and some other things with grant money. And in this case, they had passed a state law prohibiting it, but the governor vetoed it. And so they put it forward in a referendum, which in Wisconsin is a constitutional amendment. So they now have a constitutional amendment that says private money can't be used for any election facilities. So like the example I got was in Dane County in Madison. They used a grant from Zuckerberg's organization to fund steel cages, locked cages to keep the ballots safe. Well, who wouldn't want them to do that when you're so concerned about ballot fraud? That seems like a really good thing. And the opposition said, well, this all should be funded by government money, so there's more accountability. Well, the government's underfunding elections, and they're understaffed, and they don't have the equipment, and they've pulled ballot boxes, drop boxes, and they're reducing the opportunity to vote. And now they're saying, you can't seek outside money. We're not going to fund it adequately, and you can't get anyone else to fund it either. They're states all over the country that are doing this.
Would you feel the same way if it was the Koch brothers that were funding some measure to get out the vote or ensure the vote, and maybe it seemed to be a little more sympathetic to the other side?
That's funny, because I was saying to friends this morning, I'll bet the GOP would be happy if the Koch brothers funded that sort of thing. That's how divided we are, right? But I think the question is, what are they using the money for? And if it's a legitimate cause, mm-hmm. then let's go forward with it. So yeah, if the Koch brothers want to provide locked steel cages to keep ballots secure because they're worried about ballot fraud and how the ballots are mishandled, then go ahead and pay for that. But actually, they're not concerned about that. They want as many loopholes as possible so that if they lose the election, they can then claim there was fraud. But the more secure the ballots and the process are, the less wiggle room they have to complain if Trump is once again defeated.
And the truth is, we need to underscore this, that study after study has shown that our voting systems in this country are not perfect, but the instances of widespread voter fraud are vanishingly rare. I mean, almost unheard of. And so all this carrying on about the rigged elections is just designed to create political division. We know that if Trump loses in November, no matter how much he loses by, how many states he loses, he will claim fraud. He will carry on. He will try to incite his supporters to stop the certification or to take to the streets because but you see this kind of this irresponsible election discrediting going on all over the place. I don't think that it helps, and I don't think that it's based on truths. I don't think dead people are voting in Chicago. I mean, they may have 70 years ago or 60 years ago. You know, people I'd love to talk about the 1960 election where it looked like old man Daley stole some votes for Kennedy. That was 1960. I mean, that was 64 years ago.
In other news, see if I got this right. Floridians will get to vote in November on the state's abortion ban. Ron DeSantis ran on limiting the window for a woman's right to choose to 6 weeks. The high court there greenlit that law, but also allowed for an amendment that will protect abortion rights, maybe up to 15 weeks. So in November, reproductive rights will be on the ballot, and that will spur turnout in the upcoming election, maybe more on the left. And I wonder if this is going to backfire on the Republicans. DeSantis' effort to out-Trump Trump on some of these issues might actually turn out to be favorable for Democrats.
Are they on the ballot, the Florida voters, are they going to be able to choose between a 6 week ban or a 15 week ban? What exactly is their choice going to be? Do we know?
I believe it's a referendum that would allow abortions to the point of fetal viability, which can be up to 24 weeks, I believe. And that would override the law that was passed.
So people who are pro-choice, will they come out enough to vote to overrule the DeSantis abortion ban? That's what's going on.
Right.
Okay, now I did it. Thank you.
I will add, in order to pass in Florida, it needs a 60% vote, which while we talk about how abortion on the ballot wins every single time, even in red states like Kansas and Kentucky, they only had a 50% plus one threshold. I don't believe any red state has reached a 60% threshold.
You know, I'm reading from Rex Hubke in the former Tribune columnist in the USA Today. A poll found that 59% of voters think abortion should be legal in all or most states, but that's a national number. I don't see the Florida number here. So you think maybe, Marge, it won't pass in Florida with the 60% threshold?
Oh, I think there's going to be an incredible fight, a down and dirty fight to make sure it passes, whether it will or not. It's a high bar.
But it does bring more Democrats out.
Oh, absolutely. Meanwhile, those Democrats are going to come out and they're going to vote for Biden as well, you know. And I think women, you know, women are the wild card in one election after another now, right? Black women showed us something in Georgia. Black women, white women showed us something else in the 2016 election. And I just think women will be energized to come out like never before in Florida, and we'll see what happens. Abortion isn't just a women's issue, and I object to my own characterization of it as such, as well as anybody else's, because there are men involved in these liaisons that lead to the need for an abortion or the desire for an abortion, and it affects men as well as women, and it affects the whole community when you have children that can't be supported and don't then pay, you know, if there's the whole spiral about then the education system. What's that like in Florida, and how are they prepared to accommodate more children that don't have family support and solid incomes in their family and all of those things? It affects the whole community. And I think increasingly there's becoming an awareness among voters. It's not just the woman who holds the child in her body who is impacted.
Right, but since we are the ones most directly physically affected,
absolutely,
we do tend to care about it just a teeny weeny bit more.
This is bad news for Trump. Trump won Florida by 3.4 percentage points in 2020, and Obama won Florida before that. It's not really a swing state anymore. It's trending red, but the Republicans are going to have to spend money they don't have and don't want to spend down in Florida to damp down any enthusiasm for these abortion rights people voting going out to vote and then saying, well, it's got to vote for Biden too. Trump has been out there talking about how he's the one who killed Roe versus Wade. He's playing to his base really strongly. He hasn't effectively made any transition or pivot to a general election campaign. I don't know if he's going to. He has talked a little bit about setting a 15-week federal limit, but that really infuriates the people who are opposed to abortion rights because they want 6 weeks or less. They'd rather have it be, you know, they want to get rid of IVF. They're still strategizing on how to get rid of IVF around the country. They don't have their finger to the wind of public opinion. And I think that this could be one of those situations like we saw with gay marriage back in the early part of this century, where the Republicans were putting this on the ballot just in order to bring out conservative voters to vote against gay marriage. And now, of course, the opposite would be true. If you put gay marriage on the ballot, not that it can be overturned, as the Supreme Court's are right now, but the support, public support for gay marriage is strong. Trump is coming out, talking about he wants to get rid of the Obamacare, the ACA. Again, it's an unpopular position. You look at the positions that he's taken, they're not poll tested. They're not smart. So this is going to be a problem for Trump. He's going to be asked about what his position is, and he's going to be able to not going to be able to keep dodging it. I think that this could be a really major development in the presidential race.
But it's in Florida. It's not a state. You think so? Florida is sufficiently close, Eric, that this could change the outcome?
I said 3.3 percentage points, which is. You know,
Florida,
it's
to me, is very red. I'm surprised the margin was that close. I just can't imagine Florida voting for Joe Biden or even.
Well, there are all kinds of things. I mean, the other thing is that there are a lot of Latino voters down in Florida, and they have been trending away from the Democrats, which is a problem.
Sure.
So, but I think it puts Florida in play where it wasn't before. And the Republicans are not doing well raising money because they're spending all of it on Trump's legal defense. Biden is killing them in fundraising. And so they're going to have to devote resources to Florida where they probably weren't going to any more than the Democrats are not going to devote any resources to Illinois.
There's a lot of private money that's going to shore up the fight against this referendum. It doesn't have to be the RNC's money exactly. But, you know, there's two ways to win, right? One is to do what you and Kate are suggesting, Eric, that is respond to public will and tailor your positions based on what the voters want. And the other is power, right? You have the power. These entrenched Republican states have the power to set their maps. The Supreme Court will slap you every now and then, but mostly they won't. They have the power to set your voting regulations. The other referendum that passed in Wisconsin says that only election officials, vaguely worded, can do election work. That seems to mean that if a voting machine breaks down, a vendor can't fix it because they're not an election official. You got to wait till some county staff person who knows how the equipment works comes out to fix it.
They didn't define election official in that?
No. And they didn't even define the work exactly. So no one, I'm pretty sure there'll be some lawsuits to stop one, if not both of those. But they're trying every way they can. They're taking away drop boxes for mail ballots. They're limiting how you can turn in your ballot. They're limiting access. They're not letting people give you water if you're in line in a hot city for 3 hours. You know, they're finding ways to use their power as the minority to limit the vote. So on the one hand, you're totally right of what the majority of voters want. But that doesn't mean these heavily entrenched minority legislatures are going to and governors are going to let it happen.
It does remind me a little bit, Eric, you were talking about same-sex marriage. I was in Minnesota when all of that happened, but it was against the law for same-sex individuals to marry in Minnesota. But it was a year where Republicans didn't think they were going to get much voter turnout. So they said, let's put an amendment to the Constitution and we'll say double down and you can't change the law. We'll amend the Constitution so there cannot be same-sex marriage. And that got the other side to turn out so much that not only did that amendment get defeated, but then a new legislature changed the law. They had what they wanted, but they thought, let's play this game, get more Republicans out on this red meat issue. And Democrats showed up and the law changed as a result. It is a 180-degree different result than what they – I mean, you could have almost seen that coming, but boy, did they miscalculate on that. It had the exact opposite effect.
Well, it's all like the gun issue, right? It's where's the energy? That if you have people who are opposed to abortion rights who are feeling kind of comfortable that Roe v. Wade was overturned, then they're not as energized as they were. And you've got Democrats and men and women who are exercised about this and really want to come out and protect – reproductive rights for women, protect abortion rights. I think the enthusiasm gap is going to play. And it's the reason on the other side that there's very few, you know, common sense gun laws in this country, because the people who love their guns really love their guns and they really work hard at it. It's really important to them. And the people who want gun control, it's on their radar, but it's not something that they are primarily voting on.
Right.
And I think you're going to see that enthusiasm gap. You've seen it in states already. You've seen it in a number of states where they've held these referenda. So I think that it is definitely a net positive for Democrats, what's going on in Florida. And if it puts Florida in play, if Democrats win Florida, that could be the ball game right there. It's a lot of electoral votes right there.
You all were interested in what's happening over at WBEZ, the public radio station in town. 14 people, is that the right number, were laid off? Was it today?
It's 14. The move is to terminate nearly 15% of the 62 unionized content creators at the National Public Radio affiliate in town. And as this news story points out, the job cuts coincide with the opening of a $6.4 million state-of-the-art studio at the Navy Pier offices, and huge pay increases for Matt Moog, who's he's their lame duck CEO. He's making more than $600,000 a year. While they're out holding out the tin cup, asking for donations to keep their operation afloat, it's really a sad story. You've got people who are excellent journalists and content creators. Sounds kind of modern, but they're making excellent podcasts over there. Our friend Brandon Pope is Pope's podcast. I know he's got other gigs. He'll be fine, but he has the Making podcast on BEZ, which is very good, and that's on the list of shows that are going to be stopped. I think it's a shame, and you know, this is something that we saw a couple of years ago when BEZ and the Sun-Times merged. Everyone was like, this is a great synergy, and we've got this grant money and the future is really bright. This is bad news. I think 4 Sun-Times employees are going to be laid off also. They didn't specify who they were. So it broke a Wednesday morning, and it's bad news in local media.
As a former contributor to WBEZ and NPR, as a freelancer, I'm very sad to see this, but also mystified. You're right, Eric. It comes out just about a week after their last pledge drive, right? And that's sort of odd timing to me. But also, I think it's wonderful that I hear new people on their newscast every week. I'm just amazed at the many voices, and they've made an effort to hire, I think, a highly diverse news team, which is wonderful. But were they mismanaging their funds? Were they putting too much money in one place and not enough in another? The content creators are key to the success of any broadcast organization. That's why we're doing a WGN podcast, John, right? So I think you need that kind of digital content as well. I just discovered, I belatedly have to say, the Making podcast, and it's wonderful. I mean, the amount of work that goes into that is really impressive. And I thought that's what we fund public radio for, so that they would support that kind of quality work.
Did they have any idea yet whether they were blaming this in any way on WBEZ taking over the Sun-Times?
To their credit, on BEZ's website, they've posted a story by Dave McKinney.
It's with BEZ, but it contributes to both. Yeah.
But it's a no-holds-barred news story, and it quotes the union talking about, the losses are devastating to our listeners and to our members, and this decision contradicts Chicago Public Media's commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. In a separate statement to members about the cuts, the union described itself as outraged and devastated by Wednesday's news. And the layoffs create a gaping hole in our station that cannot be filled. This is on BEZ's own website. I give them credit for posting that. Tribune didn't even cover its own strike.
This is
pretty good. But they have this huge new rehab, this wonderful studio out on Navy Pier, very luxe. And they're paying, like I said, they're paying Matt Moog more than $600,000 a year, which, it may be market rates for CEOs of these things, but at some point, you're asking people to part with their hard-earned money to support the station, and you're paying this guy that much money to run it. Apparently it says here that the station reported an $8.7 million profit at the end of the from July 22 to June 23. So I don't know what's going on over there. The loss of those jobs and the loss of that talent is really tough.
But to your question, Kate, that article goes on to say the financial upheaval that led to the layoffs raises questions about the long-term viability of the $61 million BEZ Chicago Sun-Times merger now in its third year, although Matt Moog holds out hope for the marriage. I would say you asked a good question and the answer is not available.
Well, we all know he should not be making that much money.
Yeah, I don't know what market rate is for general managers either, but wow, does that sound like a lot of money.
It's consistent with
what major... I'm not saying he can't make that much money someplace else.
CEOs, I know just a tiny bit about broadcast radio on the AM side, the commercial side, and that sounds like a lot of money to me. That sounds like a lot of money to me to pay a broadcast manager these days. This isn't the 1980s. I'm trying to think of the era in which there was a bunch of million-dollar DJs in town. This is 2024. All media, all traditional media is contracting, particularly on the radio side. And I know that public radio has been doing pretty well relative to, say, other stations. But welcome to broadcasting in 2024. I don't wish them any of this, but I can't say that it shocks me just knowing what the radio revenue landscape is like. If they're suffering from the same contraction that we are in the AM side, yeah, that's what happens. That's why the money spent on a studio or a general manager strike me as pretty ambitious numbers. And frankly, the number of people that it sounds to me like they employ strikes me as pretty ambitious too. That's just what's been happening in our industry. I don't know if the union isn't getting a fair shake here, but if the numbers don't justify the number of employees or the number of programs, this is what happens.
I think that's the right context, John, because I think the salary otherwise compares to other major nonprofits in the city. Look at the salaries of the people who run our major museums, who run our major theaters. I don't think that pay is very far off from what head of the Goodman or Steppenwolf makes. I'm speaking off the top of my head. But, I believe major nonprofits have those large salaries. But your context is the more appropriate one for this industry. I think they need to not see themselves as in that league, but remember that their business is radio and radio is contracting. It is only thriving to the extent that they continue to invest in these content creators, because that's the way people are absorbing radio increasingly. And to turn a blind eye to what the industry is doing in the way you described it, John, I think is mismanagement.
And it's hard to make money on a podcast, even a good podcast. The numbers you need to achieve to actually return on investment is not easy to do. Let's move on to something else. ShotSpotter. Should that be something that is determined by individual wards in the city, or should the city overall have one policy about ShotSpotter?
Alderman Brian Hopkins made a good point about this, that the way it operates, although he himself says, if I had a choice, I would keep it on my ward if this is how we were going to go. But realistically, it is not something that really operates in that fashion. It's really supposed to be a more holistic thing to really work. So really the whole point of it was Alderman David Moore who originally proposed this to say we get to say whether or not we keep it on a ward by ward basis, I think is really just a way to force Brandon Johnson potentially to keep it on a citywide basis, because it has to be contracted for through the city. You can't
That's right.
Do that
yeah, good point.
Individually by the alderman.
A ward can't buy it. I guess you could if you wanted to, but that doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does seem to me that the aldermen in the wards where ShotSpotter is most active want to keep it, that the citizens there want to keep it. And critically, the superintendent of police, Snelling, says that he wants to keep it. I don't know why Brandon Johnson thinks he knows better than those aldermen and the chief of police and his superintendent of police. Apparently, they say that it's very effective in detecting shots being fired and getting officers on the scene. It doesn't necessarily seem to minimize crime or to solve crimes, but that it is getting officers to the scenes of shootings and bursts. Sometimes there are no 9/11 calls, so people have just given up calling 9/11. I don't know, but the police do show up there, and sometimes evidently they find injured people and they get them to emergency rooms and they save lives that way. This is what is being said on the ground. It does seem to me that you could make something like this a ward by ward the system. It doesn't seem, I mean, if there are aldermen who have problems with ShotSpotter, there are no ShotSpotters up here. I'm in the Irving Park neighborhood. We don't have ShotSpotter up here, and there's no call for it. And I imagine that our alderman, who is Samantha Nugent, probably wouldn't want it, especially if it had to come out of some aldermanic budget. But it does seem to me like something that should be under local control. And I feel the same way, by the way, about the decision to get rid of police officers in schools, which there were school communities that were telling the school board and telling the mayor, we want these officers in our schools. They are helping. And they were saying, you know, there's some more ideological overlay to this and saying, like, no, we think that overall, in general, police in schools is bad. Overall, in general, ShotSpotter concentrates police activity in black and brown neighborhoods, and that's bad, and we're over-policed. I think you need to ask the people in those communities if they feel over-policed. You've got to ask the aldermen in those communities. So,
yeah. I'm not sure those are the experts in effective policing. I mean, are we heading down a road where we would have a police commander of every ward report to the alderman, like we used to have about streets and sand, which, by the way, was not an effective way to pick up garbage. So we have a grid system. It's a little bit better. But there's studies after study that show ShotSpotter is not effective. I'm looking right now at the MacArthur Justice Organization study, which reviewed deployments for 21 months in Chicago from 19 to 21. And the data showed that 89% of the ShotSpotter reports led to police finding no gun-related crime. 86% turned up no crime at all, amounting to 40,000 dead-end ShotSpotter deployments. It's not an effective tool, and there's one study after another that says so, and doing it ward by ward is not an effective way to do policing. We have citywide police for a reason, and they're accountable to the mayor for a reason as well.
Well, then why did the mayor decide he wants to keep it for what, 9 more months? I mean, he could have just cut it off a couple months ago when the contract ended. He wanted it for the summer. Somebody thinks that it works. Mm-hmm. Superintendent Snelling thinks that it works. The aldermen think that it works. They are saying that overall, well, there's the police department has some statistics talking about the number of people who have been, they say their lives have been saved by ShotSpotter because the police have shown up on time. And they say that in something like 60% of the cases where they show up where there has been gunfire, no one has called 911. I believe that it doesn't help solve crime. It may not even deter crime, but it may have other benefits. And these communities seem to think so. And the aldermen seem to think so. And the police superintendent seems to think so. And the mayor, I guess he thinks it's going to work during the summer because he seems to think so because he kept it rather than stopping it. So there's something's going on here. And that's why it feels more ideologically driven than overall they're looking at the wrong statistics.
But, and there is a study that was funded by ShotSpotters is 97% effectiveness, but that hasn't been brought out and reinforced by any of the legions of studies done by private institutions around the country. So people may think so. There may be an intuitive feeling that it's a good idea, but statistically, that is not true. And I wouldn't be so sure that the mayor extended it just for the summer for the reasons you said, Eric. Why not think about it like it could not be abruptly turned off because the police department wasn't prepared to use other methods that would transition to awareness of gunshots and other things. You can't start the way, I mean, he waited too long to make his decision. It wasn't abrupt. It was badly handled all around. I would certainly agree with that. But to say we're turning it off this Friday would leave the police department scrambling to figure out what other methods and what other kind of, you know, tools they wanted to use. This way, you've given them time.
I don't understand that at all. What do you mean? It's scrambling to do what? I mean, that's where they'd go back to the way they did it for decades before ShotSpotter. They would respond to 911 calls and go to, I mean, it's got to be doing something. Otherwise, why would he not just cut it off?
Don't you think it would change deployment?
Well, I mean, he wanted to push it through because that's what he campaigned on. So his, you know, his most ardent supporters who helped get him in office, he said he was going to do this. And so that's what he did. He very clearly did not collaborate with the aldermen on this at all. The aldermen were very clear about that and very unhappy about it. At the committee meeting on Monday, Alderman Monique Scott, I think, was the one who really specifically talked about that. How come nobody asked us? And actually, Alderman Moore, who is the one who proposed this, said, you know, we should all be talking about this and collaborating with the mayor since he's somebody who's always talking about collaborating. But he didn't collaborate because this is what he campaigned on. He just wanted to do it. The studies are very conflicting. There's definitely some studies that seem to indicate it doesn't do a whole lot. But at the same time, it came out that Chicago Police Department stats show 80% of the calls did not have an accompanying 911 call. So there would have been no response were it not for the ShotSpotter. And apparently on 430 occasions since 2021, when they have responded to ShotSpotter with no 911 call, they have been able to give medical aid to people who have been shot, people who otherwise maybe would never have been found, who would have died possibly.
Your first point gets back to what we were saying about Alderman Sigcho Lopez.
Yeah.
In that, what's the difference between campaigning for something and governing to make it happen? And your point about collaboration is well taken, Kate. I feel like any abrupt decision, whether he'd abruptly kept it permanently or cut it off, we weren't, as a public, certainly as the alderman, the group that he works with, prepared for that. There are all these studies. The overwhelming number of studies that I'm seeing show that it is not effective. But what you said about the 911 calls is not does not line up with the fact that most of the ShotSpotter signals there was no shooting involved. How do they square this up? And what is the viable analysis that helps us really understand how this works? There was no attempt to share statistics or any of the basis for his decision. He didn't just campaign for this because his voters wanted it. He campaigned for it because there is evidence that it is not helpful and, in fact, maybe harmful in some communities. And, Eric, don't worry, I'm not going to get into the story. Story of the poor young boy who was shot the Toledo case is a sad, terrible case, and there's different ways to look at it, but I'm not going to take you on that case. But the point is, there's a lot of discrepancy in the analysis, and if he had a case to make, and I believe he had a strong case to make to stop it, then he should have put that forward. You campaigned on it, now you're governing on it, and you have to explain your actions so that we understand how you're running the city.
Why not keep it for another year, collect your own information, and try to have real stats to go by instead of, you know, my study says this versus the study from these people say that?
I just wanted to clarify that with this idea that 80% of the calls that ShotSpotter makes don't have a 911 call, but if 85% of those don't involve any gunfire, then maybe there was no reason for people to call 911. I mean, it's I don't know, and I haven't read all the studies. I have certainly read. I certainly know there are conflicting studies, and as far as I know, Marge is correct that the vast majority of them show that it's not effective. I don't know what effective means in this case, but you know, Mayor Johnson, he campaigned on a fully elected school board also, and then when he got elected, he changed his mind. So I and he preens about wanting to be really interested in democracy and democracy's rules, but he's the one who stopped the idea of a referendum on the sanctuary city. He didn't want democracy to prevail there. And my guess is that he's going to put his foot somehow on the idea, Pat Quinn's idea, of having a referendum on whether we should have taxpayer funding for the stadiums for the White Sox and the Bears. And in voters in Kansas City this week rejected some public funding for their stadiums there. So it might be that the mayor's interest in democracy is somewhat limited.
That'll get the voters to show up. And there's one other thing we're going to talk about. We'll talk about it next week. That will be the plight and flight of birds in our city. And they will be there, and that topic will be next week as well. So thank you, Marge. Thank you, Kate. And thank you, Eric. That wraps up the podcast this week. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Whoa. All right.
There was a lot to cover there.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.